Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And during the first half of the show today, we'll be speaking with Joseph Wilson, an assistant professor of biology at Utah State University, about native bees. As we said, studies, including Dr. Wilson's own, show that there are over 1,000 species of bees just within the state of Utah. And today, Dr. Wilson's here to tell us all about it. So thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
So let's start with this. You know, many of us, when we hear bees, we think of maybe honeybees or bumblebees. But what's kind of the full picture of native bees in our country?
Yeah, that's a good question. So most people, like you, probably think of honeybees and bumblebees. That's what we're used to seeing on our cereal boxes and other things like that. In the United States and Canada, we have a total of about 4,000 species. So a lot more than just those two that we think of. And these other bees, these native bees, don't all look like honeybees and bumblebees. Some of them, most of them, are much smaller than honeybees. Some of them are much bigger than honeybees. Most of them aren't black and yellow like we normally think of. We have blue bees and green bees and red and yellow and all these different colors and sizes and shapes of bees.
And Utah itself is a hot spot for bees. It sounds like a diversity hot spot. What does that look like?
Yeah, so everything east of the Mississippi River, there's about 750 bee species. Utah, just in our state alone, we have over 1,000 species. So we have about 1.5 times as many bee species just in Utah as the entire eastern U.S. And a lot of times people wonder why that is. And part of it is because there's more kinds of bees in desert landscapes than there are in other landscapes. And this is true worldwide. So there's more kinds of bees in the deserts than there are in the jungle, for example. But Utah is also unique in that we have a really wide variety of desert habitats that are separated by high mountain ranges. And so these high plateaus we have and these low canyons we have, they all support different kinds of bees. And so we have this kind of interesting shape of our state with certain kinds of bees over in the Colorado Plateau by Moab and other kinds of bees out in the West Desert. And St. George has its own unique fauna of bees. And so we have this really unique opportunity here to celebrate the bee diversity that we have in our country.
And you've done quite a bit of research yourself, kind of looking for new bees, right?
Yeah, I have. I spend a lot of time out chasing bees.
How do you start with that? What does that look like?
Yeah, well, so, you know, we say that Utah has about 1,000 species, and we say about because we really don't know how many bee species we have. Almost every time we go out and do different kinds of surveys for bees, we find new stuff, or at least new stuff for our state. And so to go and collect bees is actually a pretty time-consuming process. So I'll give an example of a project that I was fortunate to work on when I was back in college. My friend Olivia Messenger Carroll was doing her master's project down at the Grand Staircase National Monument. Her goal was just to know what kinds of bees live there and kind of figure out what habitats they lived in and other things like that. It took 4 years with about 10 people every summer, all summer, out catching bees. So we would go out to specific locations, and every other week we would go back to that location and resample for bees. And so the team of two people would collect with nets, and sometimes we would use some little bee traps, but we would try to visit every kind of flower because the information that you get from what flowers are visited by what bees is pretty important. But so it's a pretty time-consuming process. And so even in that four-year study, we ended up finding 660 bee species in the Grand Staircase National Monument, and several of those, up to 50 of those, were undescribed species, so new to science. And so it's like that kind of all over the country, that as we go out, 50 undescribed species down in the Grand Staircase, and then another 100 that we're not sure exactly what they are. They're not unique enough to say that they're new species, but they need more research done on them. So there's a lot of unknowns in the bee world, especially out here in the West.
Is if I go out for a walk, a hike, I come upon one. Is it possible if they sit still long enough, I could take a photo of it and then kind of upload it to an app or so and help me identify it?
You know, that's one of the really tricky parts with bees is we would love for that to be available, like it is kind of for birds or for some plants. Mm-hmm. The tricky part is with 1,000 species of bees, many of these, and you know, some of them are 4 millimeters long. It's really tricky because a lot of the characteristics that scientists use to distinguish among these bee species, a lot of them are pretty microscopic. And so me back in my lab is I'll collect bees and bring them back to the lab, and I have to spend a long time looking at the characteristics and comparing these little characteristics to other known species. I kind of use an example. So there's several species of zebra in Africa. And when the zebra is, you know, as big as a small horse, you can see the differences in their stripes. So you can see that one of them has fatter stripes and one of them has thinner stripes. But imagine if those zebras were, you know, 3 or 4 millimeters long. It'd be really hard to tell the difference when that little teeny zebra was running around without, you know, looking at it under a microscope. And so that's what we're dealing with bees. If the bees were big like a horse, it'd be easy to tell them apart, probably.
Right.
But when they're so small, they look nearly identical without a lot of practice. That being said, though, you can tell the differences between a lot of these bees, at least to some level. You might be able to tell the difference between a carpenter bee and a leaf cutter bee pretty easily in your backyard as you're sitting looking at these bees. And so we're trying to develop different kinds of guides and different tools to help people identify bees. But the process is pretty time-consuming to try to whittle down 1,000 species, or in the country, 4,000 species, into something that's more digestible.
Well, isn't that why God gave us graduate students, Professor Wilson?
Exactly, except I'm
that's
at
what
the
I was told
USC
when
campus.
I was a graduate student.
So. Yeah, no, for sure, right? That's me too. I'm at the Tooele campus of Utah State University, and so we're focused more on undergraduate education. And so I have limited graduate student resources at my disposal.
Well, one of the resources that you have created in partnership with Olivia Messenger Carroll is a book called The Bees in Your Backyard. And I've had this for a few years, and I broke it open again this morning. I was paging through, and I saw that in kind of your dedication of the book, you talk about how involved, you know, or like how important in your life kind of this has been, looking at these new bee species, doing this research, and your entire family will head down to the desert with you and spend their days, quote, helping you as well. So, you know, what time of year do you do this research? Do you spend the summers down there? Give us a picture of what a day might look like. You head out, you find a certain spot or a flower or a rock. How do you start?
Yeah, you know, it's really awesome. This is one of the best things about my job, is that my family is like integral. They play integral parts with it. And I can take a step back, because I actually met my wife. She came back from after doing a summer's field work with Olivia down in the Grand Staircase catching bees. And so I met her, and she was telling me these stories, and I was fascinated that there was this really good looking girl that was interested in hiking and catching bees. And so I started pursuing that relationship, and she's the one that actually got me a job in the bee lab up in Logan. And so my bee career really started because I met that girl, who is now my wife. And so my wife and I have been doing this bee work, you know, since we knew each other. And then when we had kids, it was just a natural part of our lives. I was a graduate student at the time, and so our summer family vacations were out catching insects. And it's the same thing now, as soon as it gets warm outside. But I'm lucky because bees in Utah, there's stuff you can learn about bees everywhere. So I have a lot of different projects that I do just in my yard as I go and look at bees. And my kids have luckily enjoyed it so far. They like to go be outside, and so sometimes they'll be playing with their trucks in the sand dunes while I'm looking for bees. But really, we just go to almost any spot in the U.S. you can find interesting bees at. And we're lucky that we like the desert Southwest. So, you know, I've spent time this year already looking for some rare bees that are on rare plants. And so my kids come out and help me scan the flowers for rare bees, or we're always on the lookout for bee nests that I can try to document and make some videos about. So it's just, it's kind of a family endeavor, and it also kind of lights the fire of science in these kids as they learn the scientific method and as they get to go out and, you know, see how science works, the good, the bad, and the ugly, because sometimes there are some long, hot days when we're sitting there looking for bees and we don't find them. So popsicles usually help with that, and
right,
you know, maybe a swim in a river or something. But
if you just join us, we're speaking with Joe Wilson. He's assistant professor of biology at Utah State University and the co-author of the book, The Bees in Your Backyard. So some general questions here to parse out differences. Again, like, you know, we talked about bees, bumble, and honey and otherwise, but do wasps and hornets and yellow jackets fall under those same categories?
Now, that's a great question, and it's one of the reasons we actually started writing the book is because in society, people started getting more aware of bees. But Olivia and I noticed a lot of errors, especially in different news outlets and things. They would talk about bees, but they would show a picture of a wasp. And so if we look broadly, bees and wasps are close relatives. They're all part of this big same category of bees, wasps, and ants, kind of these stinging hymenoptera. The difference is that bees are herbivores. They eat and feed their babies plant-based material, pollen and nectar. Mm-hmm. And wasps largely are carnivores. They eat and feed their babies other insects or other meat products. So wasps are hunters, and they kill insects and feed those to their babies. And bees forage for their food on plants. So other than that behavioral difference, there's a lot of overlap in what they look like. A lot of wasps look a lot like bees, and a lot of bees look a lot like wasps. But if we can be aware of those behavioral differences, we will avoid making the mistake of cursing the bees that are buzzing around us at the barbecue, because those are actually wasps that are looking for the meat in our hamburger or our hot dog or whatever we're eating. So people like to think of wasps as being mean, and if we think about that biologically, they are predators, and they do have that, you know, predatory disposition. So maybe in our way of thinking, they are a little bit meaner than bees, but they're more aggressive because it's part of their nature as predators.
Well, do they provide any service, not to us, but to nature in general? Are yellow jackets good for anything?
You know, they actually really are, and I've thought a lot about making a book like my Bees in Your Backyard book about wasps. And so if bees are pollinators, which they are, wasps can also be good pollinators, but their primary role in the environment is as a predator, and their main prey source are soft-bodied insects. Mm. And so a lot of the pest insects we have in our gardens and in our yards, those are controlled largely by wasps. So yellow jackets, for example, will hunt caterpillars and grasshoppers and other things like that that we don't necessarily want in our gardens. And so, yes, they do play an important kind of pest control role in the environment. And so even though we don't necessarily want them on our picnic table, they are pretty important in the environment.
So when we think about bees and wasps, you know, you said it's really difficult to tell apart, but are there some key identifying factors where we maybe know something is a bee and not a fly or a wasp? It sounds like they have an incredible diversity in their appearance. You know, they're a rainbow of different colors and a huge range in sizes. Is there any identifying feature?
Well, so there is, if we want to get technical, there is one feature that distinguishes bees and wasps, and it's the kinds of hairs that they have on them. Wasps and bees both can be hairy, but bees' hairs, somewhere on a bee's body, it has branched hairs. So instead of just a simple hair like ours, it'll be a hair with a bunch of little branches coming off, like a lot of split ends or something. So that makes the bees look more fuzzy, and it's thought to maybe assist in pollen collecting and carrying pollen, these branched hairs. Mm-hmm. Wasps don't have those branched hairs. They just have simple hairs. Under a microscope, it can be really clear when it's flying around your face and you're not sure if it's a bee or a wasp. You can't really see that. But generally, overall, because of these behavioral differences with their diet, usually wasps don't have as much hair. They usually look a little sleeker. They have long legs with some spines on them. So they have that kind of this look, this kind of hairless. They usually have really bright markings, black and yellow or black and orange. Bees generally are a little bit fuzzier. Their legs are thicker. So instead of carrying, you know, a caterpillar under their body, they carry pollen. So they have thick, hairy legs most of the time. A lot of times they have less distinct markings, but that's not always true. There's not a lot of black and yellow bees. If you see something black and yellow, it's usually a wasp. Mm. So there's those general kind of overall characteristics you can look at, but there's a lot of tricky ones out there too.
So I would love to talk a little bit about their habitat as well. Where do all of these native bees live? What kind of places do they depend on?
Yeah, you know, it's an important thing to think about because a lot of people are interested in helping bees. We know bees are important, but if we don't understand their habitat needs, it's hard to make steps or efforts to help them. So one key thing to realize is that 80% of the bees in the United States live underground. They're solitary ground nesting bees. So there's no hive, there's no honey produced, there's no queen and workers. It's a single bee digs a hole in the ground, and that is her nest. In that hole in the ground, she'll make a couple little rooms, and in each little room, she puts pollen and nectar and lays an egg on it. So most bees are solitary ground nesting bees, and many of those like to nest in bare open patches of dirt. So if our yards are really well manicured and they look really nice with, you know, grass and mulch and other things like that, it doesn't leave a lot of bare open dirt for these ground nesting bees. And I found in my yard, if I make a concerted effort to leave some bare dirt somewhere, maybe in the corner of my flower bed or in the corner of the backyard, I do have bees nesting there. If you build it, they will come mentality. But if you leave some bare dirt, there's lots of bees that will nest in that. Other bees nest, they don't nest in the ground. They nest in pre-existing holes. In nature, they'll find an abandoned beetle burrow in an old log or something, and they'll go and make a nest out of that. And so we can provide that kind of habitat in our yard by making bee nest boxes. They're basically a block of wood with holes drilled in it. And there's lots of different resources online to learn how to do this. But so we can provide these habitat for these solitary bees. If we don't recognize that most bees don't live in hives, we might be missing the point that most of the bees don't need a big hive to live in, or they don't do well with lots of big hives around their neighborhood.
I have to say, a couple of years ago, my coworkers gifted me a little bee nest box for my birthday.
Right.
And I put it outside thinking like, well, you know, who knows if anything will end up. I mean, it was full. It immediately was full of bees. And they would use all the different kinds of like little burrow sizes. And so I just have to share that because I agree with it. If you build it, they will come. I just put it up and it was
no
used
food.
Immediately. Yeah.
No signs.
No directional signs.
And they just arrived, and different species.
Yeah. The tiny little holes, the huge holes. It was so fun to watch.
Something to be aware of with that is because when you say you're bringing lots of bees to your yard, sometimes that sounds scary. But most of these solitary bees are pretty docile because they don't have a big hive to protect. They can sting, but people rarely get stung with them. You pretty much have to grab it and squeeze it to get stung. You know, me and my kids will stand 6 inches away from our, we call it a bee hotel because it sounds friendly.
I like
but
that.
But we stand 6 inches away from our bee hotel, and they just go in and out and do their work. It's really, really fun.
And do they all get along? There's such diversity in these times and days. Do they get along at least?
You know, most of them are pretty, most of them do get along. There are some that are kind of bullies. If you sit in your flower garden and watch, you'll see some bees will chase other bees away. Hmm. They kind of have a territory around a flower. But most of the time, there's not a lot of big conflicts. I actually have a little children's book that me and an illustrator friend wrote recently that kind of talks about that conflict that we have in society and compares it to bees because it starts off with a honeybee that thinks that she's the only kind of bee out there and she's the best kind of bee. And as she meets these other bees that aren't like her, she realizes that bees are really the best because they're so diverse.
Ah, well done.
Important messages.
It is. It is an important message. We just have a couple minutes. One question I got.
Real quick,
and you answer hopefully just quickly. How far north do bees travel? Can you, you know, are the, what is their coverage?
Yeah.
We know they like the heat and the stuff, but how far north will they go?
Yeah, so there are bees. There are more kinds of bees in the desert, but there's bees up above the Arctic Circle. There's some bumblebees that actually own some species of bumblebee that only live above the Arctic Circle.
Wow.
So bees will go all the way north as far as you can. As long as there's flowers, there will be bees. There aren't bees in Antarctica, but there are up in the Arctic Circle.
Wow.
Where do they live? I mean, are these ground nesting solitary bees? They live in the permafrost? Yeah. Like in the...
Yeah, so, Yeah, bumblebees are actually a social species, and they have small hives with, you know, maybe a couple dozen workers. Those ones up far north, most bumblebees everywhere live in abandoned rodent burrows. And so they can just find, they won't dig down deep enough to get to the permafrost, but maybe in some of this, you know, peat mossy areas or other, under some leaf litter or in an abandoned rodent burrow or crevice in a rock, they can make their nest.
You know, I guess we're laughing about kind of burrowing into the permafrost, but yeah. If I recall correctly, you have talked about bees that will actually kind of burrow into actual sandstone, right? They'll hollow out a nest in sandstone in the desert.
Yeah, we have those in Utah, and they were just recently discovered a couple of years ago, discovered and described. They actually chew, there's different levels of hardness in sandstone, but they'll find some soft sandstone down in southern Utah, and they actually chew into it. And as the longer the female lives, the more worn down her jaws become. So if you have an older female, her jaws are kind of worn down to little nubs because she's worn them down chewing through that sandstone.
Wow.
And yeah, I was talking to a local beekeeper. So now we're talking about honeybees, domesticated honeybees. Mm-hmm. And he said that during the spring, at least up here, dandelions are a really important source of pollen and nectar for bees because they're like the first quote unquote flowering plant. And so, you know, we think of, you know, we're taught that dandelions are kind of the scourge of the lawn, but they provide a benefit to at least honeybees and maybe other bees too in the early spring.
Yeah, so there are a lot of native bees that do visit dandelions, but dandelions aren't native to North America. And so you have to think, well, where did these native bees, what did they eat early in the spring before dandelions were brought over by European settlers? And so I actually did a kind of a mini study with my kids this spring. In our neighborhood, we walked around when there was dandelions blooming, and there was also an early blooming willow. The willow had a lot more kinds of bees on it than the dandelions, at least in my neighborhood. Hmm. And so, yes, dandelions can be important, but there are lots of other native flowers that bloom early, too, that probably support a wider diversity of bees. And so I'm a proponent of dandelions in our yards. But we also should be aware that there's other native flowers that do as good or better than dandelions.
Well, Joseph, we could talk with you all day about this. Oh, Chris is begging for one more question.
One more.
And then we'll have to wrap up.
All right, one more. I got to get your thoughts on the murder hornet. What's the deal? What's your
good
position
question.
On that?
Of course. No, my position is they are actually not called murder hornets. The official name that most entomologists use is the Asian giant hornet.
Wow.
And nobody called it murder hornet till recently. So the short story is they're a really big hornet. They live in Asia in the kind of lowland forested areas. They accidentally get moved around the world just like lots of insects do. They are never going to get to Utah, most likely, because we are not the right habitat for them. Mm. And as far as we know, they are not established in North America yet. There was a few sightings last fall, and we think those were exterminated before they were able to spread. So far, we don't think they're established here, and they are just a big hornet. So think of it like a big yellow jacket. Not fun if you bug the nest, but they're not extremely dangerous like the name murder hornet suggests.
it may imply that it's worse than it actually is.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. All right.
Good.
All right.
Good to hear.
All
That's
right.
encouraging.
Yeah.
Thank you.
One less thing to worry about right now,
yeah, exactly,
or at least as much about. Well, as we wrap up, I just want to ask you for the best resources for our listeners. Where can they go online to learn more about this, and what resources are out there for people who are interested in bees?
You know, there's more and more resources becoming available, but they're still kind of limited. And I'm most familiar with my resources. So to toot my own horn, I do think that our book, The Bees in Your Backyard, is a good introduction to bees. It talks about all the different kinds of bees in North America. As far as field guides,
it has incredible photos.
Thank you. Yeah. And me and Olivia took most of those pictures. So we do like to go chase bees with our camera as well as with our nets. But we are working on actually some field guides right now. A field guide to the bees of the eastern U.S. probably will come out next year, and the field guide to the western bees is probably another year after that. It's a pretty time-consuming process. We also have some folding guides available. These are the kinds you see at national parks.
Right.
Those are on Amazon if you look up, guide to common bees of western North America or eastern North America. But there's a lot of online resources that are becoming more available. both their social media sites. We have a lot that are called the Bees in Your Backyard on various platforms. But the Xerces Society is doing a lot of good work. And various states are really coming out with different guides, online guides to bees of their state. In some states, that's easier than Utah because they only have a couple hundred species. But but if you look up bee identification tips online, there's some stuff out there, but we still have a long way to go.
And your children's book, is that also available online?
Yeah, that's on Amazon or on our website. Our website is thebeesinyourbackyard.com. And so we just self-published it, so we have plenty of copies to send out if someone wants to get it. So it's called Bees Are the Best, if they're looking for it.
Fantastic. Well, Dr. Joseph Wilson, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth to talk about Utah's native bees.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.